Originally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. It's a combination of some updates as well as some things from the recent past to bring you here as we kind of mix it up for the Reporters Roundtable Thursday. Let's start out something with an update here from a Howie Politics Indiana creator and originator, and editor, Brian Howie. Brian's with us in Indianapolis. How are you today, Brian?
Excellent. How are you?
I'm fine. Thank you. Let's start out here, a little update, and we'll kind of cover the range of things you definitely do in your website. The last one that I took a look at, I haven't had a chance to check today's, but I know yesterday that you were starting off on the listing of issues involving the NATO summit. And I know that we have updates, and we'll get into that if you have caught up with that, which I'm sure you have. But let's first take on the ongoing issue, of Indiana Attorney General Curtis Hill. We know, as watching the news, what has happened and has been the allegations that have been flying around from some people from here in Northwest Indiana and elsewhere. And we now understand this has all kind of gone up, I guess, to a special prosecutor is going to be coming in and taking a closer look at all this.
Yeah, Curtis Hill has really gotten himself into quite a quandary here. I mean, politics 101 for an elected official, you don't appear in public intoxicated as a General Assembly investigative report indicates, and keep your hands to yourself. And what I'm hearing is that he kind of missed the lessons on both those fronts and kind of left himself open to the point where the entire Republican establishment, Governor Holcomb, Lieutenant Governor Crouch, the General Assembly leader, Secretary of State Connie Lawson, Susan Brooks, who's a former DA, and the Senate nominee Mike Braun have all called for him to resign.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a catastrophic collapse of your political support. It's going to be hard to see how he can survive in that kind of environment within his own party.
And I know, too, that he was pretty much considered an up-and-comer in the Indiana Republican Party, too. This is not going to help him, certainly in that respect, if things work out in his favor to be able to continue on.
Well, Hill's problem was, he was seen as this rising star. There really wasn't any place for him to go. Mm-hmm. Governor Holcomb's going to seek re-election in 2020. There won't be a U.S. Senate mm-hmm. nomination open until at least 2024. And that's assuming that Mike Braun, doesn't defeat Senator Donnelly. And then it also really exposes the party to a real problem. I mean, we were expecting President Trump to come to Indiana to campaign for Braun, two, three, four times this coming fall. And yet now you have all these Republican leaders saying that there's zero tolerance for any kind of sexual harassment. And yet, the President of the United States is kind of the horn dog in chief. He's been accused by 11 different women of some kind of sexual harassment. There's the famous Access Hollywood tape where, you can grab them by their blank. This really kind of is a civil war within the Republican Party standing at its supermajority apex, and it kind of puts everybody on notice that there is, zero tolerance for this kind of behavior, and, that could hurt Mike Braun, because I think he was really counting on President Trump to come to Indiana and really gin up his vote on his behalf. That's a big problem now for him.
Does it look like that this special investigation that has been called for is going to amount to anything, even with the special prosecutor now, because Marion County Prosecutor Terry Curry has kind of recused himself from the matter because he's so close to the situation. He says the Attorney General handles his cases.
Yeah. Well, and in Curtis Hill's defense, the General Assembly investigation wasn't really an investigation.
Yeah.
A true investigation would have talked to everybody involved, including the accused. That didn't happen. So I think Hill's correct that, he's been proven guilty as opposed to being maintained innocent until proven guilty. And, the political verdict has already been weighed out by the governor and other powerful Republicans. So now he faces a possible criminal probe. But I just don't see how he revives his political career. I just think that's in tatters right now. And I just think it's going to be almost impossible for him to get back to where he was just a month or so ago. And the other thing was a real overreach here. You have the marriage platform plank where Governor Holcomb and Chairman Kyle Hupfer tried to expand the definition of marriage to include, you know, grandparents, gay people, that kind of thing.
Right.
And the convention, by a commanding, overwhelming voice vote, said, no, we're going to stick to the Mike Pence era, you know, marriages between a man and a woman. And after that, I mean, there were some in the social conservative circles that were angry at the governor, and they were whispering in Hill's ear, you know, oh, well, maybe we ought to challenge him in the 2020 primary. And I have to tell you, nobody's going to beat an incumbent governor in a primary, particularly a Republican primary, and particularly as popular as Holcomb has been. So that was a real fool's errand in the making right there.
One thing I know, too, and you mentioned in yesterday's a column online about the fact that that Vice President Mike Pence was going to be going out doing some campaigning, which is not surprising for some of the people that are up in the midterm elections. He was he's making stops, I guess, in Indianapolis today. He was in Chicago supposedly yesterday. I wonder if he may have made the rounds, if he was able to do so, into Northwest Indiana. We know that Governor Holcomb was scheduled, according to one local online column. He was supposed to make a stop and do a little fundraising for Team Holcomb, as he called it. That was supposed to be visiting, I guess, Dan Dumicius's house up here in Schererville yesterday, which I'm guessing went off. And so there are obviously some opportunities to come up, do some fundraising for the party. And I wonder maybe if there's a possibility, and it would, I guess, be a slight one at that, there'd be enough, I think, publicity by now to say if he ever did or not, if Michael Pence ever came over this way.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I know Pence is going to be in Indianapolis and Brown County over the weekend. And he's going to wheel us up, scheduled for Sunday. They describe this as private events.
Mm-hmm.
But Mike Pence is basically on the ground here in the Midwest trying to shore up the rural vote, which could be in play here because the Trump tariffs are not only hammering small manufacturers who use aluminum and steel, but the tariffs are just hammering soybean prices, and we got a lot of farmers that are really going to be taking a hard hit to their wallet. And so Pence has been to Iowa, Kansas, Indiana, trying to reassure their rural supporters that the president has their back and that there's actually, you know, some kind of method to the tariff madness, and we'll have to see how that goes.
Mm-hmm. In fact, I know you devoted an entire column, last Sunday to talk about the issue of the Trump tariff situation and the impact it's going to have on farmers and, of course, how it's affecting farmers here in Indiana. Do you think that we're liable to see any relief, so to speak? Is that one of these things that's going to happen, I guess, after the president comes back from all of his trips overseas?
I don't know. I mean, in my view, it just looks like Trump is winging it on so many fronts. You know, the North Korea thing where, remember, he goes and meets with Kim Jong-un and tweets out immediately, you know, we can all go to sleep. Sure, there's no longer nuclear threat. Well, that's not the case. The nuclear threat still exists. There's people in his administration that will even acknowledge that. Mm-hmm. He's being described as a wrecking ball in Europe right now. He has put NATO on notice. He's just been savaging our closest allies, calling them delinquents and suggesting privately that the U.S. could pull out of NATO, which basically has effectively, for the past 70 years, kept Europe pretty much at peace, other than the Bosnia-Croatian civil war, a generation ago. And then he's going to pivot, and on Monday he's going to meet with Vladimir Putin one-on-one with just translators, nobody else in the room. And that's just leaving him open to even further allegations of potential collusion with the Russians. Now, you know, we've talked about this in the past. I'm waiting for the Mueller investigation to come out. I'm not going to jump to any conclusions on the collusion front. But I have to tell you, the president is leaving himself open for that kind of criticism.
And I know that there have been some other columns, too. And in fact, you mentioned one of them here in one of your recent online columns about an article that is in, I guess, the current issue of a New York Magazine, a very, very disturbing account from one reporter who did obviously an awful lot of legwork and a lot of searching back through the files to come up with the information about the links that he saw and the concerns that have been addressed here about the relationship between President Donald Trump and Russian President Putin. And I took a look at the article as the link went to, read through a lot of it, and it's the kind of article that makes you scary sometimes. It's thoroughly scared about things these days.
Yeah. The article is titled, "Will Trump Be Meeting with His Counterpart or His Handler? Plausible Theory of Mind-Boggling Collusion." Going back to the 1980s, when Trump, as a businessman, went to Russia, tried to do business there, and how, you know, Vladimir Putin uses financial methods and other types of blackmail to get people to do his bidding. And I have to tell you, there's the one story that just kind of blew my mind in regards to this was that meeting at the Pentagon about a year ago, last July, with Defense Secretary Mattis and Rex Tillerson was there, and they spent an hour detailing the value of NATO, why NATO is so important, why NATO needs to be supported. And at the end of the hour, Trump had been silent, and then his comment was, that's exactly what I don't want. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what led Rex Tillerson to call him using the F word,
yeah,
you know, effing moron. That's where that meeting came from. And now here we have Trump at NATO even suggesting that we might pull out. I mean, you know, Vladimir Putin's got to be thinking, you know, am I dreaming or not? That's exactly what he wants to do. He wants the European Union to dissolve. He wants Great Britain, the Brexit thing, to pull out. He wants NATO to be weakened. And Donald Trump seems to be doing his bidding, you know, almost on a monthly basis here.
I imagine even the president's remarks made early this morning that we carried in large part as he made them in the 4 o'clock and 5 o'clock hours in particular, coming from after the summit ended, everybody was confounded. All the reporters that had been watching all of this and listening to all of this were saying this is just a complete turnaround that the president has handled in comparison to what he had said and tweeted in the last 48 hours.
Yeah, you know, I mean, normally, you know, if an American president says, are you thinking about pulling out of NATO, you know, the response would have been, are you crazy? You know, what kind of a question is that? Or are you going to let, you know, the Russians keep Crimea, which they annex? You know, Trump thinks that the Russians should be allowed back into the G7. Today, he said he didn't know how he was going to handle that. I mean, you know, everybody from Obama to the Bushes to Reagan, you know, they would have emphatically endorsed U.S. Involvement in NATO. They would have absolutely demanded. That would have been one of the key things in a face-to-face with a Russian leader. You know, hand back the Crimea and get your butts out of the Ukraine. You know, but he's not doing that. It just seems like Trump is doing Putin's bidding, and there's really no explanation for it. Nobody has really any explanation for it, other than the fact that they think that Putin has something on him. And so, you know, as I've said before, Senator Young told me, don't jump to conclusions. Wait for the Mueller report to come out. That's what he's going to do. We'll come to some conclusions then. So I'm going to be patient. But I have to tell you, you know, there's a lot of smoke billowing out of the vents on this one here. And Trump is not doing himself any good by going to see Putin after he, you know, savages our own allies. And then he's going to do so one-on-one with nobody else there. Then what are they really going to talk about? It's bizarre.
Mm-hmm. We can only hope that that somehow or another we find out what actually is discussed in that session, since there will be so few people in the room, so to speak, that day whenever they get together in Helsinki, to be sure.
Right. The optics are not going to be good for him.
No. And maybe that's why he had tried to turn things around here in this news conference, impromptu one that he happened to call, surprised everybody earlier this morning, I should say, and tried to turn things around here so that in hopes that the optics will look better when he goes to Helsinki, I suppose.
I suppose. I don't know. We'll have to see. It's going to be fascinating.
That's very, very true. We've been talking with Brian Howie, who has created and is the editor of Howie Politics Indiana, about some of the latest information that he has had in his online columns and the other reporters and the other commentators, rather, who have talked with him and put out this material as well, too. And Brian, thanks for spending some time with us here on the program today to talk about this and bring us the update. And that, not only are we watching closely what happens with President Trump, but apparently with the other politics that happens in Indiana, like with Attorney General Hill, and see how the investigation there goes along, too. Thanks for spending some time to talk with us today.
Yeah, I'll be writing about the Hill Hill situation. You'll be able to read that in the Times this weekend.
Oh, great. Great. Appreciate the notice about that. And thank you. We'll talk to you soon. You're listening to Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. Let's turn now to Carol Carlson, who's covering stories for the Post Tribune. And a number of stories, Carol, I know that involve the Gary Community Schools, but let's hit one first for the city of Gary and the pushback, I guess, that the Mayor Karen Freeman Wilson got for making a trip down to the border. Tell us about that.
Well, it was actually 2 weeks ago now.
Yeah.
Karen Freeman Wilson is an officer in this National League of Cities, as well as a participant in the U.S. Conference of Mayors organization. And she was invited to make a trip down to Texas to visit the detention center where federal officials are housing children who have been separated from their parents. A lot of elected officials have made that trek down there, and she joined them.
And I guess the mayor made it primarily because of the fact that she's such a bigwig with the U.S. Conference of Mayors, and she's going to be the president of the organization.
Yes,
here.
She is currently the vice president,
yeah.
And for the next term, the way that organization is set up, the vice president is automatically elevated into the presidency, and she felt like she, by virtue of her participation in that organization and her soon-to-be ascendancy to the presidency, that it was important for her to be there on behalf of the organization. So
mm-hmm.
That's what she told me, why it was important for her to go. And she was gone. She really wasn't gone all that long. I think she left on a Wednesday and came home Thursday evening. So it was a short trip, but she drew plenty of criticism for it.
I understand. Yeah, what seems to be the hubbub that kind of created the stir on social media. I guess in another day, you would say that all these comments would have shown up on the Quickly column in the Post Tribune, but in this case, they all showed up on Facebook and Twitter, I imagine.
Yeah, unfortunately for the mayor, and I was working that particular weekend, when she, right after she arrived home Thursday night, a series of shootings just erupted in Gary. I believe they might have started Friday night, carried into Saturday and Sunday, and upwards of, I think, 16 to 18 people were wounded, and one man was fatally killed. So it was a rough weekend for Gary, and armed with the knowledge that the mayor was down in Texas, the social media folks went to town.
Well, and we know since then that things have kind of calmed down a little bit. At least they seem to have anyway in recent weekends. But just the same, it's always, an interesting story when it comes to taking a track on the violence that happens in the city of Gary. And if it just happens to be that the mayor isn't sitting around waiting for things to happen or waiting to go out there and check things out, they're going to complain.
Yeah, as she explains it, her involvement in these mayor's groups gives Gary some national exposure, and it also allows Gary to become eligible for several grants through these organizations, and the city has won several of these grants, so she thinks it's a win-win for the city, mm-hmm. And she doesn't plan on dropping out of any of these groups.
We're talking with Carol Carlson with the Post Tribune about stories that she's had in the newspaper as well as online. And I had a number of stories here recently here about the Gary Community School Corporation, one of them in particular, giving Wirt Emerson High School alums a chance to make one more stop through the school before it closed up. Tell us about that.
It was a sad, bittersweet day. When I arrived at Wirt, and I did not attend Wirt, but could certainly sympathize with some of these alums.
Yeah.
there was a large moving truck parked in front of one of the doors, and they were hauling equipment and desks and stuff out. And the other door, alums were going in to say, you know, make their last goodbyes. And the school was set up nicely for that. They were doing tours, and they had yearbooks spread out so people could reminisce. And it drew alums from all across the region who came to say goodbye to their school, which is now on the sale block.
Mm-hmm. And we'll find out more about that in just a moment here. But we know that that I guess when you mentioned about the moving van being at one door and then the alums coming in to check out the for the tours on the other, I wonder if they've hauled some of this material away over to Westside Leadership Academy already.
Yeah, as you walk through WIRT and they had desks lined up in the hall, they had little signs, handmade signs on the desk that not only said Westside, but they said what area of Westside, like biology, room 101, or something like that. So they seemed fairly organized on where all this stuff was going to go. And emergency manager Peggy Hinckley has said in the past that when Gary closed schools, they did not decommission them correctly and left a bunch of valuable stuff inside. And in her case, she said that, you know, they've already had one auction of WIRT equipment and everything of value that can be used at Westside. They're moving out over to Westside or other schools, and she says that WIRT will be closed up properly and be less enticing to vandals and scrappers.
Well, that leads us directly into the next story that we wanted to take a look at here on the program today. Was the story that you wrote up here about the some 33 vacant Gary Community School Corporation schools and properties that are out there on the real estate market. Tell us, I guess, how, of course, we know how these situations happen, but what seems to have happened since then?
Yeah, it's no secret that Gary has these vacant schools. They dot the landscape, over 600 acres of you know, very sad-looking, crumbling schools in most cases. And the school district has received its share of complaints from neighbors about the condition of the schools. And Hinckley and her staff have set the process in motion to start selling these schools. It's a two-phase process. In the first phase, according to a state law that was passed when Hinckley and her group came in for this takeover, involves the city and institutes of higher education, that in this case that would be IUN and IUN, within the Gary boundaries, have first dibs on purchasing these schools if they have any interest in them. After the initial 30-day period, the schools will be offered to the general public. As far as I know, I don't think the city would be interested. They're selling off assets of their own right now. They're trying to sell the Genesis Center and Gleason Park Golf Course and other facilities. So I don't think that an Ivy Tech, for example, is selling its Gary campus on 35th Avenue and King Drive, so I doubt that they're interested. So I don't know how much interest in this initial offering is going to be out there. Hopefully, when they offer it to the general public, there will be some of these schools that can be sold and repurposed and still serve some value to the community.
And I would imagine probably some of the buildings that are in the best shape, like Dunbar Pulaski School, and maybe to a lesser extent, I think maybe like Lew Wallace High School, because although I know the arsonists hit it, they didn't wreck the building completely, but it's still possible they might be able to fix some of that up.
Yeah, I think Lew Wallace is in pretty good shape, and the school board did have an offer for the school that a church offered $100,000 for it back in 2014, but the board did not sell it. And I'm not quite sure why they didn't, why they spurned that offer, but it seems to be in pretty good shape. There's a community group, Levita Sparks Wade and others are, Richard Ligon, are cleaning up the grounds regularly. Ligon runs a Pop Warner Football League that plays at the Lew Wallace football field, so they're keeping the track and the grounds up pretty nicely.
Yeah, I drive by occasionally, and I do happen to see that. Of course, if you drive by the front of the school, you see it closed up, but you don't see any unsightliness to that. And you're right, the back there on the track area itself looks very nice. Even though the school's closed, they do keep it clean, so they should at least the neighbors in the area there, so they don't feel bad about that. So that's no for sure. One other story, the two we want to touch on today is take a look at, I guess, talking again about the emergency manager, Peggy Hinckley. She had a ruling from a judge, which turned out pretty well in her favor. Tell us the reason that the matter came to court and the judge's ruling.
One of the members of, at the time he probably wasn't, but a Gary attorney, Clorius Lay, represented a citizen who was concerned when Hinckley came into power in Gary. She was meeting informally with school board members and updating them on some of the business of the district. And complainant, Derek Hill, hired Clorius Lay, who's a Gary attorney. He's also on the Gary fiscal board, appointed by the school board.
Mm-hmm.
And Lay concurred with Derek Hill that this could be an open door violation, that she should be meeting with the school board in public to update them. He took his complaint to the public access counselor, who determined that because the school board has no authority any longer under the state takeover law, that it was not a violation. Lay was dissatisfied and disagreed with that ruling, so he filed a lawsuit in Lake Superior Court. And just last week, the judge there, Bruce Parent, ruled in his analysis that the school board does not have authority, so it is not in a position to violate the open door law. So Hinckley did not violate the law.
I know that that Dr. Hinckley had said at the outset when she came into Gary that she would do her best to try to have regular briefing sessions for the school board members so that they were aware of it, because I know she wanted to make sure that they were, ambassadors to the community and that they could let people know what was going on with the Gary Community School Corporation, even though they were no longer as elected the school board members.
Yeah, part of Hinckley's charge from the state was to keep the school board, albeit even though they had no authority, but they were still supposed to be apprised of goings-on in the district and business of the district. The state did not spell out how she should do that, and there was very little information on how Hinckley would interact with the open door law, this is such a different situation. So she struck out on her own and just started responding to board members or trying to update them, and in that fashion of just sitting down and meeting with them.
I wonder what Mr. Lay has to say now, even though that he didn't win his case in court, so to speak.
Well, he said he was, he still disagrees and he's disappointed. He's still a member of the Fiscal Management Board, which meets, I think they meet quarterly,
mm-hmm.
and they advise Hinckley on financial matters.
Well, we'll see what happens further in this, of course, too. Another one of the stories in the ongoing saga involving the Gary Community School Corporation. Carl Carlson is a reporter for the Post Tribune. She covers stories in the city of Gary and ones like the ones we've heard about today. And as always, Carol, thank you for joining us on Regionally Speaking, and we'll talk with you again soon.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Indiana U.S. Democratic Senator Joe Don Lee will have his hands full over the next few months in trying to defeat Republican candidate Mike Braun in his first re-election bid this November. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Zach Bernard had a chance to talk with Don Lee last week to talk about the future of the Supreme Court, immigration, and the direction of the country's Democratic Party as the midterms approach.
The 2018 Farm Bill passed the Senate 86-11 last week, and you were actually responsible for some key provisions in that measure. So walk me through some of those.
Well, one of them that's absolutely critical to our state is providing telemedicine to our rural areas, and it helps specifically in regards to addiction treatment services. We have an opioid scourge throughout our state, and I was able to get included in the Farm Bill telemedicine services to our rural community, so someone can simply, in effect, call up Methodist Hospital in Indy or talk to Parkview or Lutheran in Fort Wayne or even Mayo Clinic in Minnesota and be able to get medical help from them right at their local USDA facility.
Just last week, Justice Anthony Kennedy announced his retirement from the Supreme Court. President Trump gets to select his successor and will make his announcement on July 9th. You voted for his first appointee, Justice Neil Gorsuch, last year. So how will you ensure that rights already ruled on will be protected by the next justice?
Well, what I'm going to do is review whoever the choice is. And we don't know who that will be. We'll see on Monday and then review the record carefully and make a determination after that.
Should the nomination wait until after midterms?
Well, Mitch McConnell is going to determine when that nomination comes forward. And I will work on it as is my job responsibilities whenever it comes before us.
Senator, you came out against the Trump administration for its policies of separating families at the U.S.-Mexico border. Later that week, the president signed an executive order to reverse that policy, and a federal judge demanded families be reunited by July 26th. You remain a proponent of securing the U.S.-Mexico border, so assuming all families are reunited on that date, what's next in the immigration debate?
Well, I'm hopeful that at some point the administration can take yes for an answer. And what I mean by that is we've been able to put a number of immigration bills together on a bipartisan basis. 10 Democrats, 10 Republican senators. I was one of the Democratic senators who worked to put an immigration bill together. The president indicated he would sign it, but then the administration did not. And so I'm hopeful in effect that the president and the administration will take yes for an answer, and we can have good, strong borders and also common sense immigration policies.
Now, we can talk about Democrat and GOP divisions all day. Let's talk about inter-party division for a moment. We saw the Abolish ICE movement grow the last several weeks. Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez won New York's Democratic primary. Some Democrats are saying the party's shifting too far to the left. With midterms in November, what do you think the party's priority should be?
You know, I don't get into party priorities. My focus is Indiana. And so what I try to work on every day is good jobs, good opportunities, and I actually think the best politics is to just do your job well.
Speaking of midterms, you are up for re-election in November. You've distanced yourself from some signature stances of the party, like abortion rights and your vote to confirm Gorsuch. Do you worry that this could result in a less than enthusiastic response from your base at the polls in November?
No, the Democratic Party in Indiana, what we pride ourselves on is working to get a good job, to make sure that there are good job opportunities for everybody, that we stand up to protect health care, and that at every turn we're there for working families, and that's what I'll continue to do.
Schools now have more guidance from the state because of the new graduation pathway requirements. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Jeannie Lindsay tells us that educators and school leaders have been stressing the importance of locally created options for the school districts.
When the State Board of Education approved new graduation requirements last year, educators shared a lot of concerns. Many questioned how they could make the new standards work in vastly different schools for every student. This month, the board approved a guide to clarify different parts of those standards. Board member Byron Ernest says now schools can use that to shape their plans moving forward.
Now it's just a matter of, in all cases, those schools, communities coming together and really answering the question, what can we create together?
The new graduation requirements go into effect in 2019. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Jeannie Lindsay.
Ball canning jars have not completely been made in Muncie for some time. Only parts of them are still being made now. But soon, ball canning jars will no longer be made in Muncie. That'll be the first time since the company's first jars came off the assembly line in 1888.
After founding a company in Muncie, a town with enough natural gas to create a booming factory, and lending the family name and financial support to a local teacher's college, the Ball Corporation's headquarters left Muncie for Colorado in 1962. But ball jars have continued to be made in part in Muncie. That is, until next summer, according to current owner Newell Brands. In a statement, the company says it's closing the Muncie factory in summer 2019 due to what it says are needed upgrades and improvements to the plant. A for-lease sign is already in front of the company's local office building on Muncie's south side. Newell says ball jars will soon be made in Columbus, Ohio, and distributed from Fishers, Indiana. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Stephanie Weekman.
And that's it for Regionally Speaking, Reporters Roundtable Thursday, and more here on this Thursday. I'm Chris Nolte. Thank you for joining us. We hope you'll be back with us on Monday.